As we get seated, would you join me in prayer, please? Gracious God, we thank you for this gorgeous fall day. Prepare our hearts and minds to hear the story of faith, art, and activism of Dr. Evelyn Nicodemus. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Evelyn Nicodemus is this year's artist in residence at the Overseas Ministry Study Center of Princeton. Dr. Nicodemus will share how her life has been marked by movement and how that movement is reflected in her art. She grew up on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, moving across Europe to Sweden, France, and Belgium, before finally settling in the UK. Her experience of racism and cultural trauma has prompted the creation of a unique body of work that uses unusual materials to explore human experience, from metal nettings to sisal to textiles and found objects. Dr. Nicodemus is one of the strongest feminist voices to emerge from Eastern Africa in the past 30 years and is an artist, writer, and curator. Please welcome Dr. Nicodemus.
Thank you. Let me become an American for the first time. Thank you for having me here. I'm very honored. I was born 1954. At the slope of Mount Kilimanjaro in a quite a famous, now very famous village called Marangu. This is the, as they call it, the Coca-Cola way, the easy way to climb Kilimanjaro. That's where climbers stay at my village to stabilize, because it is a high altitude village before they do the journey up to the mountain and back. Kilimanjaro is, I will suggest, more than 90% of the populations are Christians. They are either Lutherans or Catholics. My tribe was very, accepted Christianity very early, so it's one of the oldest Christianized tribe in East Africa. The Catholic faith was introduced by the white fathers of from Italy. They are also the ones who brought coffee, the Kilimanjaro, famous Kilimanjaro coffee, to the region. The Germans were very early there. They established the first educational institutes. That's why in Tanzania, all the schools, the word for school is Schule, just like in German. And they were there before the German colonizers. They built not only school, but the first teachers training college in East Africa, which is still there, Marangu Teachers Training College, which educate teachers from all over East Africa. It is still going. They established the first hospital, which means already from the generation of my mother, we were born in our own Lutheran hospital. It is quite a westernized society, I would say. because of the early education we received. And when it comes to the Lutheranism, it was literacy was a must. You must be able to read your Bible yourself. You must be able to read and recite your catechism yourself, which means that it was quite strict. The Germans scholars do say that when they want to know how Lutheranism was practiced in the early 19th century, you have to go to Kilimanjaro, because that is exactly what we still do. It has developed further. The first Archbishop of the Lutheran Church was a relative, Bishop Moshi, Stefano Moshi, who, together with an American doctor, founded Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, one of the best hospitals in East Africa. And now it is a teaching hospital, one of the early ones as well. And now there is also a university named after Bishop Moshi, which is a university. So in a way, I come from a proud Christian community. And I'm still very proud, because I wouldn't be Dr. Evelyn Nicodemus today if it was not for the efforts of my church, and also the survival of us as small children, because we had medical care through the church. We had our church schools. We have our colleges now. We have our universities, etc. I left Kilimanjaro at the age of 18, not for educational purpose. It was just I happened to fall in love with a Swedish economist, and we just couldn't help. We were just in love, and that's it. So this is how I ended up marrying my first Swedish husband, and we moved to Sweden, where I enrolled at Stockholm University, where I studied social anthropology. The reason I decided to study social anthropology was not as a subject which I had planned to become, or I didn't even really know much about the subject in question. It was simply growing up at the slope of Mount Kilimanjaro, where all of us were black, with some exception, of course, some missionaries, some teachers at the first girls' school, secondary school, which was also founded by German Lutheran women. The notion of racism didn't enter my head, and probably that's why I married my Swede without thinking. I didn't think about his color or anything. It was just love. The color didn't enter my head. So when I came to Stockholm, it was quite a shock for me to meet racism for the first time, because somebody was telling me, "You are black." And I actually have not thought about it. So I have to look at my skin. Oh, yeah, actually, I am black. It caused me a lot of questions, because unlike somebody who was brought up in the Black Atlantic as a of African origin or in Europe, there it was not an issue. There was no question about color. There was no question about our teachers who are, if they came from German or they came from Europe, we thinking more than that, okay, they look different. So I decided to study social anthropology, thinking it might illuminate this question of scientific racism, which to my disappointment, it didn't. I had in the end to abandon social anthropology, because I started questioning if social anthropology was science at all. And if it was science, why was this discipline mostly focusing on the othered. It was mostly the literature which was offered to me was mostly about people from other countries, people who were colonized people, people in subordinate positions, and I just say, just something is rotten in the land of social anthropology. So I went back to Africa as a Swahili teacher. I'm a specialist in Swahili language when it comes to grammar, to teach expatriates, which came from all over Europe, some America. So it was people who were either diplomats or people who were working as missionaries or teachers or company directors and so forth. While pondering if I wanted to continue with anthropology, I had done my master, which means that you have to decide what you want to specialize in. And when I came to back to Africa, I was even more confused. I was not capable of, I realized I was not capable of objectifying another human to make that human to become the species to study. Just like, you know, I would put butterfly and call this and that and that. I was not capable of that. So it was just luck. We had a little bit of a group of Christian women from all over the world among the expatriates. We used to meet once a week and either exchange knowledge. It could be food. It could be a handcraft, but it could also be painting or drawing. And that's where I discovered that I've come home. That's where I discovered that I actually could draw. That's where I discovered that I was so happy when I was creating something out of an idea, out of a thought. And I decided this is my vocation. So I told my sisters that, you know what, within 6 months I'm going to exhibit at the National Museum of the country. And of course, they thought I was mad or something. But the feeling of creation filled me with so, not only joy, but also with this possibility of creating out of a thought, to create an image out of a thought or an idea. I felt that it was an adventure worth exploring. So the anthropologist was not totally away, but probably it was because I studied that subject that made me to think, you explore a thought, you want to know more, you open one layer of something and there's something else in between. And actually I painted after I had 60 paintings within 6 months. I packed everything. I flew from I was teaching at the Lake Victoria area. So I flew to Dar es Salaam, that's the capital, and I went to the museum and demanded to see the museum boss. And the museum boss, I said, I have no appointment. Who is this woman? And I said, I'm here. And here are my paintings. I want them to be exhibited in this country. What is your name? I say, my name is Evelyn Nicodemus. I think I was using my first husband's name at that time before. And he said, he was so shocked and ambushed. So he said, please sit down. Would you like to have a cup of tea? He offered me a cup of tea, and then he asked, for how long have you been painting? I said 6 months. And you think I should be showing your work in a museum? I said, yes, sir, have a look. And he was so shocked, so he said that, okay, let's finish our cup of tea and I will have a look. And actually, he gave me a show. And it became the first feminist show in the country, the first woman to exhibit in that museum. And the question, the exhibition got the name Kitchen Philosophy and Art. Because at that, I had to admit to him that actually I didn't know if I was an artist or not. It became not only internationally, radio stations talked about that. The subject of feminism also got a platform. I had come home. So when I came back to Stockholm after 2 years, I decided to sort of to check if I was really into art or was I going back to anthropology. I found that it was art, so I quit social anthropology, and I have never looked back since. I will say I did get a little bit of success in Stockholm as well when I started showing a bit of my art, but as usual to tell, it was also unusual to tell them, behind every painting, behind every image, there is a poem. There is an idea, there is a poem. And but I do not dare to show them, because what I have seen in Europe is that you do not show visual art and poetry together, because it is not an illustration. It is just something which happened to, for me to be, have a convergence between poetry and visual art. I was quite alone, of course. So I had my first marriage didn't work out, so I was living alone with my daughter, and at the same time started studying another subject, which was environmental engineering. One lady from the Swedish media decided that they wanted to find a black woman who do visual art, so they can have an exhibition at the Swedish radio and television for to celebrate the 8th of March, which is the Women's International Day. And they found one. So I ended up, you know, in the media circles. Here you are. You are the only one living in that suburb as the black person, the only one with a mixed race child, and the only one who is painting, you know, while your husband is sleeping and your child is sleeping, you are painting in the cellar. The ladies, we put up the show, and they went to the guy who was to become my second husband. He, Christian Rumare, who was the art historian, art critic, and television producer for art programs in Sweden and Scandinavia. They showed him the work. I wasn't there. And he said, I want to see the woman. And as the story goes, it say clicked, and we were married for over 34 years. And he supported me all through up to his death. From there on, as an artist, I decided that, you know, it's not only about production of art, but it's also to, I wanted my art to pose one question. And this question is universal. What is it to be a woman in the world? So when I was invited to have a one-woman show to a provincial Danish museum, I told the director that I have an idea. Rather than show the works which has been already shown, I have an idea that I would like you to invite me to this community of yours for me to tell the Danish women what it is for me to be a woman and what it is up to from the time I was born to the time to now. And from there, I think there will be a dialogue because after me telling their story, my story, I hope the Danish women will tell me what it is for them to be a woman. The museum boss thought it was totally bananas, of course. It's not possible to produce works of art from that question. But his wife had other ideas and say, Evelyn is not coming to portray us. She's not coming here to interview us. She's coming here to tell what it is for her to be a black African woman. And we, Danish women, are going to tell what it is for us to be Danish women. You can sit down there. We will organize here. We will take, we will invite Danish women from all classes, from a prostitute to the first ordained priest. And we will have our own, we will sit together as women and talk about our lives. And we will be able also to tell about what it was perhaps from our mothers and so forth. What unites us and what separates us. And it was the best ever something which has happened in my life. And from there, the suffering of racism actually ceased to exist because we had so more in common than the difference. And I could also see the artificiality of the racism as a concept which is actually shouldn't exist at all. What came from there, I asked them in the end if I could tape our conversations. And I got around 50 hours of tape of women talking, Danish women talking and I talking. And I went back to Sweden and I listened to those tapes, 50 hours tape, nonstop. And it became clear that actually the museum boss was correct. There was no images coming from there or poems coming from there. So I started panicking. So I went back to Denmark again. Now not taping anything, just selecting some of the women who touched me most and met them again, asked if they would like to meet me again so we could speak. Because I wanted to be sure what was said was actually said, because some of the things which were said were absolutely shock. There is a lot of stigma towards women experience which is not talked about, and that silence is there. You question, for example, about sexual violence in whatever stage, there is a lot of things which we women, we don't talk. And if we do, it's perhaps between ourselves, or we don't talk at all because we'll be outcast of the in the society if it is ever known. So I went back to, I checked and I found that what they said, it was what they said, and that was their truth. I went back to Sweden and I listened to the tapes again. And what I found was in places, there was a pattern, in places where we came to the deepest, to the most painful, there was no language. In places where it was the most joyful, we had no language. There was no Danish language for that. There was no Swedish language for that. There was no Swahili. There was nothing. It was silence. And there something happened. Suddenly, a poem started running in my head. And that poem is called Women's Silence. I just rushed and I wrote it down. When I went back to Denmark to paint the exhibition, it was like a flood water. Within 3 weeks, I have painted the exhibition. And it was very much praised. And behind every image, there was a poem, of course. Because now my husband had supported me, telling me, just because the museums in the world do not show poems and images together, it does not mean that it can't be done. So you do that. And by the way, who anyway design and in Swedish they say upteka, gosh, I don't know. yeah, what is a museum? Who and when was museum? This is a very, very new science. So when was art history? Art history is also a very new science. If that is new, why not having something? It could be that women think poetry before painting. We do not know. So you just, I encourage you to do that. Break the taboo or break these unwritten laws which says this is how a painting should be and this is how things should be. It was very interesting because it crossed the barrier. My art and poetry in Skive, Denmark, did not only speak to women of all classes. It spoke to men. And I was surprised the men that that exhibition talked to. It was the silent men of that community, men from the gay community. They came, they say, it made me cry. I absolutely didn't know much about gay people, or nobody has ever talked to me about it or what. It's not that I didn't know there are people who are different, but I didn't know my art, an art made for a woman, by a woman, which depict, of course, the joys of being a woman, the joys of being a mother, the joys of the many joys, but also the pain. That was also universal. A man could stand there and feel and join us. And that gave me strength. Came next question. Can I do the same by going back to my own community, going back to Africa, and do exactly the same thing, telling about me to Chaga women at the slope of Kilimanjaro, and hoping they will talk? And they did. They did. The only thing was that we have to do it secretly because they have to ask permission from their husbands. So I had to say, okay, I'm inviting you to come to Arusha, that's the next town, and you, whatever lies you're going to tell, I think you will be forgiven. So just say you're going to a party or something, or second baptism or whatever. And they came actually from all classes. And we sat, we ate together, we talked. And this time I resorted to speak, not in Swahili. I wanted to speak with them with my tribal language, Chaga, which means that those ones who were older, whose Swahili was not the best, or who didn't speak English, could join in. So we all have to go to that level that we were all we were all Chaga speakers. And I taped that as well. I got around 60 hours of tape. And I took those tapes and went to the capital of Dar es Salaam, sat down, took those over 60 hours listening. It was the same pattern. The same pattern as in Denmark, where there was silence, Oh, a little quip of, I know what you mean. But there was no, what is the word of it? We don't know. And it was, I painted, I think around 30 paintings in which was shown in Dar es Salaam. Unfortunately, I was not able to get the women. I ran out of money, so I was not to get those women like I did in Denmark to come over and see the exhibition. But it was in the Radio Tanzania, which means that those who could afford were able to travel and come and see the show. And they said it spoke to them. So what happened was that they wanted their children to come and see. So they organized school children to come to the exhibition. And majority have never been to an exhibition. Majority didn't know what a museum is because we had only one. So this was a journey for them as well. And when I came back to Stockholm, Sweden, I decided if I have done two continents, I will conclude it with the third continent. So I applied to get a stipendium to go to Calcutta, India, which is the capital of they call it the Paris of India, because of it's got very, very strong cultural traditions, and they are very, very organized. They have artist collectives, they have poet collectives, and so forth. And ask if I could do the same thing. And the ladies in Calcutta, they organized by asking, at that time it was a communist government, which means that they have, just like the women in Tanzania, they have to ask permission from the bosses or the men. Luckily, they got that. So we had the same kind of thing. But this time I didn't tape, because I was absolutely sure that it will be the same pattern, that where we have no words. And I had the poems there, the exhibition was there. Women from all walks of life came. We got the support of the government. The ministers were there. Young people were there, you see, with their girlfriends taking their boyfriends to the exhibition, and they were writing down the poems and everything. And that was my formative year, years of being an artist. I have continued with the other project. Usually I work thematically. The last most important project I did was on trauma and art, because it sounds so beautiful. It wasn't beautiful. Every time you cross a barrier or you question the norms, you're going to get trouble. So I ended up, to shorten it, being branded, I think here in America they call them feminazis. I got the branded feminist extremist. So I had troubles with authorities and all those kind of things, which resulted in a breakdown, which caused me to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. As we know, just because you've been subjected to trauma, it does not mean that you're going to suffer from PTSD. It's just around 10% of people. We scientifically, they are still working on that. Why some and why not some? I left Scandinavia and moved to France. And I was very lucky to be invited as a guest student for the Hochschule de Kunst. This is the High School of Art in Berlin. At that time, it was West Berlin. The wall, Checkpoint Charlie, was still there, by an American professor, Professor Shinkichi Tajiri, who is a Japanese-American. And he was a war veteran. He and his family were interned during the after the Pearl Harbor. And I suppose it was his brother or perhaps a cousin, but one of the Tajiris wrote to either to the president or somebody to the White House and saying, instead of letting us Japanese-American languish in the camps, why don't you train us as American citizens to go and fight for America? And they were trained and they were sent to fight in Italy. And the Japanese, he was wounded, but the Japanese battalion was the one who got I think, I don't know what you call, but they got a lot of medals and very celebrated and so on. And he, as a result, he got after the war, he got a scholarship to study art in Paris. When he heard a little bit about my story and the PTSD, he said, no, you're going to become my student. So I went to Berlin to study with him. And at the same time, he found a companion where we could talk. He told me about his experience during the war and what happened to how lucky he was he didn't suffer from what, for example, the Vietnam veterans, we know, and so forth. I didn't last long, but it was not meant I should be there for too long. He just wanted me to find out through the German professors who teach art what technique I know and what I didn't know. What did I need to perfect? How was a canvas made from scratch? What was taught in a German art classes? And what was not taught, what they knew about art from other countries and what they did not know. I think that was enough for me, but he also wanted me to live closer to him, so I moved to France to live in Antwerp near his home, which was in Holland, in an old castle which he renovated. That gave me strength to, despite what has happened, to continue believing in humanity, that actually humanity exists, because there was a time I questioned everything. I lost my faith. I just thought, where are all those Christian values? Why the silence when you see somebody suffering? And it transpired to me that actually the biggest silence is what happened during the Second World War in the concentration camps. It is not that people did not know what was happening to the Jewish brothers and sisters and all the others. They knew. And the world kept quiet. So I wanted to, just like as I excavate, what do you call it? Yeah, that is Swedish, nice of me. If I did that with women's silence, I want to do it with the silence of the world in relation with why did we allow it to happen? So I had to go to, I went to one concentration camp in Alsace, the only one in France. I went to one in Germany, and I went to one where Anne Frank passed. And it shook me to the core, really, that actually this happened. I knew, I accepted that it happened. It was not a fiction. But there I was standing there to see this was the crime place. And the world kept quiet. There are some people like Kashki who went out and tell, this is what is happening. And the world did nothing. Then I started working on what is trauma. And at that time, it was very easy for people like me because there was more knowledge in what was happening in America, that in America there were scientists from different disciplines has come together, psychiatrists, medical doctors, anthropologists, sociologists, and so on, to work with the question of trauma as such. And it was during the 80s, I don't remember exactly if it was 1980 or 81 or what, but that's when the terminology post-traumatic stress disorder was named. And as far as I'm concerned, once named, once something get named, then it gives us possibility to say, yes, this is a disease, something can be done. The scientists will jump in, the doctors will jump in. But once it is not named, we're just floating somewhere. So I went into that kind of literature, not only for self-healing, but also for knowledge, searching for knowledge. Then I was approached by Professor Jean Fisher, who is an art historian, a former zoologist, but became an art historian. And say, Evelyn, because of your published essays, we have decided in our university to put you in a list of people who candidates for a honorary degree. But in our discussion, we have decided that we think you can actually do a PhD. I, as a professor, I will take you as my student, and I will find another colleague who might jump in. The only thing is that we are not knowledgeable about your speciality, that is African modern art. We don't know much, but you can teach as well. We are teaching you as well. So I decided to use the pain of PTSD and all that confusion to actually focus on my thesis on trauma and visual art. So I started researching about what was written about visual art and trauma. There was quite something written when it comes to literature, because it was possible to put the few survivors of the Holocaust camps, like Elie Wiesel, Levi, they were able to write. And their books have been analyzed by linguists to see what was difference between their books or their writing as survivor and the writings of people who have not gone through such an experience. I went on researching further, and I found that actually I didn't need to just focus on that. I could go just to the poetry of Baudelaire, because Baudelaire at that time was touching already that, you know, when a time has gone, a new language should come. And that new language is not gonna be, you know, about the new trains or so. It is just an experience, a way of life has passed. And from there I saw that I was not going to be stopped there. It should be possible. Because in the modern art of Africans, produced by African artists, there's quite a lot of trauma because of the past experience, which means that the questions of slavery are out now and then to pop up, the question of colonialism, etc., etc. So I did my thesis, luckily, I also got my PhD for that. At the same time, as I was doing my PhD, I was contacted by a friend of mine, an American professor at Sacramento State University, who told me, actually, more than 50% of my students are not of Caucasian origin. They are either Latino or African American or other Asian And they're asking me, you are teaching me art history, whereby the history of us doesn't exist. What about Asian modern art? What about Latin American modern art? What about African modern art? You are not teaching us that. And I say, Helene, if you are going to wait for it to be done, you can just as well sit there and wait forever till you are patient. We just have to do it ourselves. So I say to her, I will do the African section. I will just do the African section, what I think is missing. And you take, I don't know what you call it in English, a marque. I mean, you take the African section. Yeah, and you just go and try it on your students. If it works, then we are on something. And actually she did. And then, okay, then for us it's just to find two who will work on the Latin American side and two who will work on the Asian section. We have no money, but we are going to do that. And I had just this belief that, you know, if we ask the people we have pinched essayed from, they will probably say, fine, yes. The only thing which is going to happen is that they had just to be understanding that we are thinking for the interest of the students and we are not thinking about their egos. We want this book to be able to be used by students in a term. And we all, the scholars, I did the African section because I knew as a woman I would be in trouble with all the sexism and all so and so and so on. And I had no university to back me or anything. So I took that section. Luckily, we got two to deal with the Asian section and two to deal with the Latin American section. We edited the book, and we didn't have a publisher. But the product was ready. And lucky, I think Jesus was on our side, we got Blackwell and Wiley. That's the biggest publishing companies when it comes to education. And it is there for American University. It is called Modern Art in Africa. It's called African Modern Art in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, An Introduction to Global Modernisms. And we haven't had any penny. This, I believe, this is the spirit of the Lutheranism I grew up with, which is still driving me. Education, education, education. And if there isn't, you create it. And this is not only, it's not a new coming from me. When I was reading Toni Morrison, where she says, if there is a book you want to read and the book isn't there, then you write it. So this is exactly actually what I did by when my friend Helene O'Brien, Professor Helene O'Brien contacted me. I say, well, you have already an American who has said that. What are you waiting? Let's just do it. So there is this driving force of a belief that if something isn't there, just like my second husband, he passed away 6 years ago, telling me, if there isn't something, or they are saying that these are the rules are there to be broken. And well, his father was a high court judge, so what am I to say? It has saved me well, really. And here I am in Princeton. When it comes to my art, the most famous work of mine is a scroll which is called the genocide scroll. Out of all this research I have done, I came across a review or just a little bit review on The Guardian about encyclopedia of genocide by an American professor, Israel Shani, and the team, who have been compiling all genocides which has happened through human history. But what shocked me, it was not that there was genocide. It was the fact that it was encyclopedia. So the image of encyclopedia in my head is about fat tombs. Is it possible? So I wrote to him and he sent me a copy of these two volumes. And I read through it all. I wrote back to him and said there's some things are missing there. For example, the genocide which happened in my country and the fact that the first genocide, 20th century genocide, didn't happen in Europe. It happened in Africa. And I wrote an essay on that genocide which happened in Namibia. And I wrote about it because I was watching pictures, and there was a picture of Goringstrasse, which is Goring. It shows that it sent me back straight to Europe, to Goring, the end solution and connection with Africa, the same family. And I created the genocide scroll, which is 16 meters long. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Museum is closed. Some of the